You know, with all the memes that are going around on the internet, I am very surprised that someone hasn't done a Porg and Bjork mashup. Like, I'm very surprised they haven't come up with Bjork yet. Everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Kaiju Weekly, the weekly podcast where I introduce my co-host to the wide world of giant monster movies. I need to stop saying weekly podcast because we've kind of missed a few weeks, so it's semi-weekly podcast where I introduce my co-host to the wide world of giant monster movies. I am the blue ring octopus of this podcast. And my fellow cephalopod is...
I am the atomic sub of the podcast.
You could be the cuttlefish. You could be the cuttlefish.
Okay.
No, atomic sub is fine. So this week we are taking on a 1955 classic. But before we get into that, let's do our usual catching up. What you been up to this week, Jake?
Let's see. This week, I haven't been up to a whole lot. I've been kind of catching up on some old comics that I've kind of let take the backside on the back burner a little bit. So I got caught up with all my Valiant comic books. Shout out to Valiant. and then other than that, there hasn't been a whole lot of kaiju-related stuff I've been into. I follow John Boyega on Instagram. And he's been posting a bunch of behind-the-scene pictures for the new Pacific Rim movie. So that's been kind of cool to see, seeing all the set design. And, like, he's like, oh, check out this armor. And it's like, it's super cool armor. Yeah, have you been, what have you been up to this week?
Not much, just working. But I did watch an episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000 the other day when I got home from work. and it wasn't a giant monster one. They were doing a, old teen drama from the 50s that they were doing. And they were making jokes about one of the actors in the movie and kept making references to Paul Anka. And I was like, are they making references to Paul Anka because this is Paul Anka? Or is it because he looks like Paul Anka? And so I had to look it up. And when I looked it up, I was like, oh, it is Paul Anka.
It was Paul Anka. I'll be honest with you. I have no idea who that is.
Have you ever watched Gilmore Girls?
Not really.
Really? Abby's never made you sit and watch Gilmore Girls?
No, she's not a fan of it either.
Oh, wow. I was going to say, they named their dog after this musician named Paul Anka. He's a relatively famous musician. He's been around for a long time. He started when he was just a teen, and he's, you know, still around. He's like 60 or 70. Something like that. Yeah, so
I'm sure it's the type of thing where if I heard one of his songs, I'd be like, oh, I know this guy, but I'm so bad with musicians to be.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I didn't really know who he was until Gilmore Girls when they named the dog Paul Anka, and I'm like, why is that supposed to be funny? Because, like, I don't get the reference. Which, I mean, okay, that is a genuine criticism of Gilmore Girls, that if you don't get the million and a half references that they have in their jokes, you're not going to find it funny. But I still enjoyed the show. But yeah, there was an episode where Lorelai, the mom, had a dream about her dog meeting the real Paul Anka, and it was just like really it was really funny. But I was like, when I was watching Mystery Science Theater, I'm like, are they just making fun of how much he looks like Paul Anka, or is this actually Paul Anka? And I'm like, oh, this is actually Paul Anka. He was only like 18 at the time. I was like, oh, okay.
trying to Elvis it a little bit with some musician to actor movies.
Well, that's one of the things about this podcast that I'm going to really enjoy as we get into some more of these older classic movies is finding out these like really, really famous people who are in these old giant monster movies. You're watching this and you're like, are they really doing this? Is this really? And it's like, but you forget, like, they had to start their career somewhere.
Right, exactly.
Or even if they were famous at the time, they, you know, people get paid to do these things, so hey. But yeah, it's like watching The Lost Continent and then you see Cesar Romero in it, and it's like, whoa, what is Cesar Romero doing in this? Or watching Little Shop of Horrors, the original Little Shop of Horrors, and it's Jack Nicholson's first movie. And my favorite, because I'm the only person, I guarantee you, I am the only person in the entire world, I dare anyone else to come at me and say that they have seen this movie. Because I guarantee you I am the only person that, I don't even think the cast and crew have seen this movie, but it's Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
Travis, I have seen this movie.
You have seen?
No, Return? I haven't.
Okay. I was going to say, you haven't seen any of the Godzilla movies, but you have seen Return of the Killer Tomatoes. In the sequel to Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, Return of the Killer Tomatoes actually had George Clooney in it, and wow. George Clooney, you know, was just starting out in movies, and it's like such a hilarious thing to have George Clooney in this silly movie about talking tomatoes.
Was it back when he, like, cause there's some early movies of him where, like, when he was younger, he just had, like, these super bushy eyebrows. They're, like,
yes.
Crazy insane.
Yes. Bushy eyebrows and just gorgeous mane of hair. Just, like, this just gorgeous hair that's, like Mel Gibson in Lethal Weapon 3 hair, you know, kind of, like, just.
Was it mullety or was it just, like, just big hair?
No, it was mullety. It was definitely a mullet. It was definitely a mullet, but it wasn't one of those really, like, grotesque mullets. It was just, like, really thick and luxurious because he's got, like, really thick and curly hair naturally. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. I mean, he looked like what he looked like when he was on Facts of Life. Because that was his first, like, really breakout role that he did was Facts of Life, and then he did a couple of things, and then he got into ER and other stuff that made him who he is today. But right. Yeah, he did Return of the Killer Tomatoes, and it was just like I am probably the only person who knows that George Clooney. I bet you George Clooney doesn't even remember doing that movie.
He's put it out of his memory. It's something that he does not want to remember.
I bet you the cast and crew don't even remember making that movie, because it just seems like one of those, like, fever dream things. Like, oh, I thought that was just a bad dream that I had one night. Oh, no, we actually made that movie. It's so good, though. It's such a funny movie. Dare I say, Return of the Killer Tomatoes is better than the original Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. Because they went full Gremlins 2 on it, where it was like, we know we cannot beat the first one. The first one was just so good, so we're just going to go completely meta. We're going to make fun of ourselves. We're going to have fun with this, and we're just going to do whatever the heck we want. And
it is there works. A tomato with a mohawk in it?
There's a big furry tomato. Ooh. That talks. There's also a tomato that turns into a very beautiful girl who actually has a nude scene in the movie.
Of course.
So there's a nude tomato.
I'm guessing this is 80s. It feels yep. 80s. Yeah.
Yep, it was the 80s. It is so 80s. It is so 80s. It's so cool, though. I love the Attack of the Killer Tomatoes movies. I don't know why. I just do. We're going to watch those for the podcast, by the way. I have them on our list. We are going to watch them. They are hilarious, though. They are meant to be funny. Like, they're not meant to be serious. Right. And they are just... Oh, they're just brilliant. They're brilliant. More people need to know about them. They are... This is top-tier filmmaking. It takes genius to make something so stupid be so good.
He previously described it as a fever dream.
So... I know, but it is still so... Well, no, I think that's what the crew thinks of it. Like, I think that they're kind of... Well, I mean, it is, though. It's like, who in their right mind thinks, hey, what if we made tomatoes talk and have them attack people and stuff? I mean, it is meant to be a comedy, like I said, so I mean, but just, and then they make the furry one, and then they make the one that's that turns into a woman, and then they make the soldiers, the tomato soldiers, so
sounds like a wacky ride.
It's like Spider-Man in the sense of you won't believe what it is until you actually see it. It's just something that has to be seen to be believed. Well, okay, so...
Coming to a Kaiju Weekly near you.
Yeah. That's enough of talking about stuff that's not even part of our episode, which is kind of a running theme in all of our episodes.
Any off new topic, Star Trek, the podcast. Next Generation? No Star Trek this week for me, unfortunately.
Okay.
Star Trek tangent? That's not the right word.
Adjacent,
thank you. I did see the new Cloverfield movie that they released, which we will be talking about on a future podcast. So I'll save my thoughts till then. Slight spoilers.
I haven't seen the
movie. It's okay. But not great.
I haven't seen the movie. So is it actually adjacent to Star Trek, or is that just like a weird thing that you
It takes place on a space station, which is about as adjacent as I need it to be.
Okay. Well, that's more adjacent to Star Trek than I thought it was, because I did not expect it to take place on a space station. So I literally know nothing about this movie other than it came out during the Super Bowl, or the trailer came out during the Super Bowl, and the movie got released on Netflix, and that is all I know.
Right.
Like, I don't know anything else about this movie, so now I know it takes place on a spaceship, so.
It takes place on a spaceship, and this might surprise you, it stars humans.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Anyway, we'll talk about it next week.
Next week.
That's going to be our next week.
Sometime episode. In the future.
Yeah. So yeah, this week we are talking about a 1955 film called It Came From Beneath the Sea. It is a black and white science it's a black and white science fiction giant monster film from Columbia Pictures. It's directed by Robert Gordon and stars Kenneth Toby, Faith I don't know how to say that last name. Faith something. and Donald Curtis. And with the creature effects or special effects done by the legendary Ray Harryhausen.
And let's be honest, that's what you're coming to this movie for, is for his awesome special effects. This is actually the first movie I've ever watched that he's done. And I was just blown away by them. They're so awesome to watch.
Yeah, and this isn't even the best ones, too, because like you said, this is kind of like an earlier one. So, this isn't even the best effects he does in some of his movies. They are really great. A little chat just a little bit about Ray Harryhausen. Now, if the listeners, dear listeners, if you've never heard the name Ray Harryhausen, please go research some of the things that he's done. He is a very famous special effects artist. In fact, his fame surpasses some of the stars and some of the directors of movies that he's done. I mean, the director of this film, Robert Gordon, he's very famous because him and Ray Harryhausen worked together so much. But Ray Harryhausen even has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
And he also has a very nice sushi restaurant in the world of Monsters, Inc.
Oh, really? Oh, is that what that sushi place was called?
Yeah. Yeah, Ray Harry... Or is it Ray Harryhausen's or just Harryhausen's? It might just be Harryhausen's.
Oh, wow. I did not realize that. It's been so long since I've seen Monsters, Inc. I did not know that. That is actually really cool.
Yeah, that was a tidbit that Abby was like, oh, hey, by the way, yeah, the restaurant in Monsters, Inc. is named after him.
That's really cool. Yeah, so he's a very, very influential person on the monster movie industry. We've talked about tokusatsu in previous episodes. Tokusatsu is the suit animation or suit work that they do in Japan. So like Godzilla would wear the big, you know, a guy would be in a big rubber suit. He'd fight some other guy in a big rubber suit in a miniature city. And that was, you know, that had taken off and become extremely popular in Japan and other, you know, adjacent countries. Here in the United States, we never really had the suit animation, the tokusatsu, take off. That didn't come until a lot of those things started migrating over here in, like, the 80s. What we had was stop motion. The first King Kong movie in 1934? Or whatever year, in the 1930s, the first King Kong was a stop motion movie. Mighty Joe Young was a stop motion movie. You know, you've got all of these stop motion animated things, and Ray Harryhausen is the king of stop motion. He built the genre. He basically was the top dog in the genre, and he influenced it so much. And I don't mean just in monster movies. I mean stop motion in everything, and in whatever movie that has stop motion. You know, all the way down to you look at Nightmare Before Christmas and other things like that. Ray Harryhausen has influenced those things, and so that's how far reaching his and just how far reaching his influence is. Steven Spielberg wanted to use that style of stop motion animation in doing the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. That was his original plan for Jurassic Park, was to use stop-motion animation the way that Ray Harryhausen had popularized to do the dinosaurs. And it wasn't until after that someone showed him some models that they created, like in like 3D models in computer, that he decided to go with computer effects for the larger effects of the dinosaurs. Wow. So, yeah. Huh. So, you know, and I'm talking like Ray Harryhausen invented it. He didn't invent stop motion animation, and stop motion animation existed before him, but he is just the king of it. He influenced it and changed the way things were done so much that his name is synonymous with stop motion animation.
Right. In a similar way, how like Steve Jobs or Bill Gates, they didn't invent computers, but they definitely revolutionized the way they were used.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So that's a little primer just on why it's such a big deal that this is a Ray Harryhausen movie. And I mean, I'm a huge fan, obviously, so I'm going to gush a little bit. So, I mean, he's, you know,
And I think it lives up to the hype too. When you watch the movie, like those are my favorite scenes in the movie, hands down, just because of how well done they are, how entertaining they are to watch. And it's just something that you kind of just have to marvel at.
Yeah, and he does such a good job of making creatures look organic when they're obviously, you know, they're not. They're puppets. But they look so organic and stuff. Oh, that's what I should have. That's what it's kind of like. Well, your analogy was really good with Steve Jobs and stuff, but he's like Jim Henson. Whereas Jim Henson didn't invent puppetry, that was, you know, had been a thing, but he did it in his own way and just revolutionized it. And so, yeah. So, yeah, that's what Ray Harryhausen did. But, yeah, just the fact that you can take these puppets and then you take it just one click, one frame at a time, and make them look so organic and actually, like, living, breathing monsters or animals or whatever they are is just amazing to me. I love Ray Harryhausen. He is one of my favorite special effects artists.
Definitely. Yeah, and I hadn't really seen much of his stuff before this, like maybe just clips here and there, but after watching this movie, I'm definitely a fan of his. I think it definitely speaks to the limitations of movies at the time to see how they got around those limitations and kind of how creative they were in overcoming those obstacles. Whereas nowadays we see kind of so much CGI, which there's an art to that in itself, but it doesn't feel like there's the same level of craftsmanship that you see in some of these old older effects.
It doesn't feel like there's a personal touch to it. Like when Ray Harryhausen was doing the effects for the movies that he worked on, you know that's a Ray Harryhausen effect. That's his work. But with computer animation now, because it takes so much manpower to render and draw and create these complex computer graphics, that there's entire teams that are working on it. So it's not one individual person's touch. It's just like, this is what the artist or director envisioned, and so this is what we did. And so that I think that's what's missing in computer generated stuff, that, like, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. Like you said, I mean, it's fine. It's got its own, you know, kind of artistry to it. But just the fact that you don't get that personal touch from one person who did all of this work. So that's enough right here. Well, one more thing. There is a documentary about his work. It was on Netflix. I don't know if it's on Netflix anymore, but there was a documentary about Ray Harryhausen. If you want to look that up, listeners, you can look that up. And it's really interesting because it really goes through his catalog of movies and talks about how the industry changed and what kind of, you know, led him to not be able to work as much, because as time moved on, his style of special effects weren't needed. And so, you know, and he retired and everything. And so it's, and he died not too long ago.
What was the name of that documentary?
Let me look it up real quick.
Because he said, and if our listeners, and I thought in my head, or Jake wants to watch this later.
Yeah. yeah, it was really good. I enjoyed, that's it. That's definitely it. It's Ray Harryhausen, Special Effects Titan. Which is a nod to the fact that he did the original Clash of the Titans.
And the current one. He did all of the work on Sam Worthington. That was all stop motion.
Yeah.
Fun fact.
They needed to stop motion Sam Worthington to make him look like he had emotional, like, emotion. it's a 2011 documentary. I think it was being produced, like, it was being produced while he was still alive, but I think it came out right after he died. So I think he died in like 2011 or 2012. I know it's fairly recent. Yeah, I know it's fairly recent because they had his funeral aired on television, his like public funeral, and a lot of major directors and actors had gone to it, like Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg and a lot of these ones, and George Lucas, all of those ones, and Tom Hanks and I think Steven Spielberg both said that he was the most influential person for why they wanted to be in movies. You watch his movies, you see these amazing creatures, these amazing things, and you want to be a part of the industry that made that.
Wow, that's pretty amazing to have such an influence on some of the, I'd argue, the biggest heavy hitters of Hollywood today.
Yeah, and for it to be such a, what we would consider an outdated style of, you know, special effects, to still be that kind of an influential person that people still respect you to this day.
Right.
You know, I think there is something special about Ray Harryhausen in his film. So that I'm just going to leave it at that, because I've gushed enough.
Well, while we're kind of still on the topic of it, do you have any fun facts about like his special effects? Maybe we can kind of also touch on what we see in the movie too a little bit, since those are really the highlights, like I said before.
Oh yeah, yeah. I have a lot of special things. Fun facts. I have a lot of fun facts. So my first fun fact is the Golden Gate Bridge gets destroyed a lot in movies.
Right.
That's not necessarily a fun fact. We know that the Golden Gate Bridge gets destroyed in pretty much every movie that comes out now.
So, off the top of your head, what are your favorite Destruction of the Golden Gate Bridge scenes in movies? I was going to throw out there X-Men The Last Stand when Magneto raises the entire Golden Gate Bridge to get to that one island. Not a great movie, but one great scene in it.
Yeah, not a great idea either. I mean, you know, you could have just... Well, anyway, you didn't need to move the entire bridge over there.
It looked cool!
Yeah, no, it was cool. I like that one. I like Godzilla. The 2014 Godzilla, when Godzilla smashes through it. I really like that.
That is pretty cool, especially since you hear all of the, like, cables snapping and it goes like the twing, twing.
Yeah, so that one, I'm having a hard time remembering all of them.
There's one in the first of the new Planet of the Apes movies. They have the worst names, so I can't remember the exact name of it, but they have the final showdown on the Golden Gate Bridge. Is that Rise
of the Planet of the Apes? Yeah, that's Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Then you had Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, and then War for the Planet of the Apes.
At least War was a little bit better.
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, you know, you go back to the original movies from the 60s and 70s, and it's Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
It came from Beneath the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it's just like all of these, all those names. I actually... As much as I am a big kaiju fan, I'm not a big gorilla fan. So I'm not a huge fan of King Kong or, like, the Planet of the Apes. I don't know why. Apes are just not my thing.
I haven't really gotten into, like, all of them. Like, I've seen the new Planet of the Apes movies, and I really like those. But past that, I'm not, like, super into, like, the ape movies.
I just know that in Beneath the Planet of the Apes, they go underground and find out that there's a race of humans that are worshipping an atomic bomb.
That's kind of fun. I like that a little bit.
I mean, sounds fun. So, my fun fact anyway, by the way, about the Golden Gate Bridge. Too much. My fact about the Golden Gate Bridge, though, was that this is actually the first movie that has the Golden Gate Bridge being destroyed.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is the first one. So when you go and you list out, when YouTubers who need views decide to do a top 10 Golden Gate Bridge being destroyed video, this was the first one. And there's more fun facts that kind of spin off of that. So I don't know if you want to do those now, or if you want me to do a different one.
No, go for them.
Okay. They wouldn't allow the film crew to film the Golden Gate Bridge.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, like the city of San Francisco would not allow the film crew to do it because they said they did not want people thinking that their bridge could be, you know, brought down or collapse. And that it was unsafe. So they were not given permits to film the bridge at all. And they weren't allowed to film on the bridge. And so what they did was they took unauthorized filming of the Golden Gate Bridge from, you know, down wherever, you know, away from the bridge. Just took it in the backdrop to use as, like, the establishing shots. And then built a model of the... Empire State Building, of the Golden Gate Bridge.
They built a model of the Empire State Building just for fun, and then they built the Golden Gate Bridge.
And then they built the Golden Gate Bridge. Like, the Empire State Building they didn't need for this film, so they put it off to the side. Then they built the... It's like they tasked that somebody... went to the special effect, well, Ray Harryhausen, to the special effects people, and I was like, okay, we need you to build the Empire State Building. Then they come back with the finished thing, and they're like, oh, crap, no, I meant the Golden Gate Bridge. Scrap it all. Scrap it.
Do you just think they'll notice?
Just turn it on. We'll film it anyway.
That makes sense, because the only times we really see the Golden Gate Bridge, it's through that Harryhausen vision. Where you can tell it's like a special effects shot. And all the other times it's either like super close up, so you don't see like the bridge fully, or it's like at the end of the bridge, and it's like right. you don't really see it at all.
Yeah, yeah, we get the establishing shots of it, which, like I said, were not authorized to be filmed, but they did it anyway, because they were like, we're going to do it anyway. Whether San Francisco likes it or not, we're going to be filming this movie here. and then they did, like I said, the model from Ray Harryhausen and the special effects team did the model, and then they had soundstage for the other shots that were, like, up close. But yeah, so yeah, you can tell that. But then it's not until you hear the fun facts that it's like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Fun fact, while being called the Golden Gate Bridge, it is in fact red.
Yeah, it's reddish-orange.
That's a dumb fact for the audience.
Fun fact, that the Golden Gate Bridge is so famous, but there's another bridge that's like less than a mile away from it that nobody ever talks about, called the Bay Bridge. Like, no one talks about the Bay Bridge. It's always the Golden Gate Bridge. There's a comedian that I used to listen to all the time. He, you know, real funny comedian. He was like, he's from San Francisco, so he said anytime his friends came over, he's like, yeah, I gotta be the tour guide, bringing them all around the city. Yeah, here's the trolleys. Ding, ding, rice-a-roni. And he's like, yeah, and there's the Golden Gate Bridge. Take a look at it. Take pictures. We're not going across it. It's like, because it's $3, that's why. Like, it costs money to go across the Golden Gate Bridge. We'll take the Bay Bridge, go the long way around.
Maybe that's why they always destroy it in movies, is because they're just getting out their frustration at having to pay that $3.
Yeah, pay the toll. It's like, take this. Yeah, so, okay, another fun fact about this movie is that, I don't know if you noticed this, I had a hard time noticing it, but I learned about this in Fun Facts, that the octopus is not an octopus.
I did not notice it.
It only has six legs. The reason for that is that Ray Harryhausen, when making the model, he was limited on his budget. Like, the entire film is shot on a limited budget. And so he couldn't create the full octopus with all eight arms, so he left off two of the arms and just hoped nobody would notice.
You just gotta angle it right and you won't even tell.
Yeah, I mean, you can't tell. It's halfway in the water most of the time, so he couldn't even tell. And so he actually nicknamed the creature a sixtopus, which is not to be confused with Sextopus, which I think was a James Bond movie back in 1970.
It sounds... yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
That's an octopusy joke. I'm just gonna, got that
just
one.
Going to politely pass on that one.
So, okay. The model ship that the octopus sinks in the film was purchased at a Five and Dime, like a Five and Dime shop. So it's just a little model that he bought from a store and just put it together and painted it and then just had the monster destroy it. Again, this movie was made on a budget.
Nowadays it would be like seeing like a Lego ship being destroyed by something.
Yeah,
right. Although, no, yeah. It wouldn't be Lego, it'd be Mega Block, because Legos are way too expensive.
Yes! Yes, can we? No, we're not going to talk about that. We've derailed this podcast enough already. But yes, they are. the submarine scenes, all the submarine scenes, were actually shot in an actual submarine. They actually took handheld cameras, which, I mean, in 1955 would have been massive, and brought them onto an actual submarine because they didn't have the money to build a set to look like the inside of a submarine.
that's funny. I was going to mention the submarine scenes because I'm slowly starting to realize that I do not do well in a small confined places. And watching them on the submarine, I was like, let's move on, please.
Have you been inside a submarine?
I have been on a battleship before, but never a submarine.
those spaces are not, they're not made for 6 foot tall people.
Right.
Because it is so tiny and cramped, and it's just like, no thank you.
Yeah. Could not. I see them and I'm like, oh, they look like coffins that just so happen to go underwater and ride around.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Oh man. Oh, does this mean we have to do as one of our movies that we review, we have to do the Descent?
I'm not familiar with that one. Oh, is that the Ryan Reynolds one where he gets trapped in the coffin?
Oh, no. This one actually has monsters in it. So this one is about a team of women who like to go spelunking, if I can talk. Spelunking, you know, cave diving. And
right.
They go down to this cave. There's a cave-in, and they get trapped in a section of this cave that no one's ever explored before. And they find out that there's, like, mutated monsters down there. But the mutated monsters aren't even, like, that big of a deal in that movie. It's the fact that they're in these cramped spaces and they have to crawl through these, like, ooh, you know, really tight openings, and then the rocks start shifting around them as they're crawling through, and it's just like, oh, if you have claustrophobia, it is the most terrifying movie because of that.
I'm not going to have a fun time watching that one.
I don't think we're going to cover it in our podcast because it's not giant monsters. They're kind of people-sized monsters. so we probably won't cover it, but just the thought of that, it's like, oh yeah, you want to see a movie that'll really make you uncomfortable. I like doing that to my friends. I don't know why I like doing that. Like, it's like, oh, if that made you uncomfortable, let's watch this. This is a more extreme version of that.
And then they just slowly walk out of the house.
Yeah, it's like, no. I don't know why I love that. I'm like, it's not like I enjoy the movie either. It's uncomfortable for me too, but I enjoy it more because of how uncomfortable it makes someone else. And how just like, oh yeah. So I don't know.
You just
like
try that. To do like immersion therapy with people.
Yeah. But see, now if someone tried to pull that crap with me, I'd stop talking to them for the rest of my life. But I do it, I'm fine. Most of the scenes in this movie, talking about It Came From Beneath the Sea again, most of the scenes were done in a single take.
Oh.
Like they wouldn't do double takes or more than one take. They would just shoot it and then, okay, let's go. And again, goes to the cost of the movie. Like, they really wanted to lower the cost.
I wonder if that's why the script is so, like, kind of bare bones. So they can just do it in, like, a take and then continue on.
No,
I mean, I guess sometimes it's not really. Maybe not. I don't know.
I think that was just more of the 1950s. That was just the thing.
Right.
So anyway, that was my fun facts. The most fun one for me is the fact that they weren't allowed to shoot the Golden Gate Bridge, but they did it anyway. And the fact that Ray Harryhausen called the monster a sixtopus. Okay, so just a quick run through. Just quick. We're gonna keep it quick and easy. Of the plot for this movie. So you have a nuclear submarine that is doing maneuvers. It's a brand new nuclear sub, the first of its kind, doing maneuvers, even though it's actually technically the one that they filmed is a diesel submarine, not a nuclear submarine.
Lies.
But, yeah. the real life submarine that they're on, that they filmed, is a diesel submarine, but we'll just say, okay, yeah, it's a nuclear submarine.
The first few minutes kind of feel like a ad for the U.S. Navy. They're like,
I was going to say
the nuclear submarine.
I was going to say the same thing. Like, we open on an ad for the U.S. Navy, and then the movie starts. Yeah, so they're doing maneuvers and testing out this new sub. It gets stuck on something. They try to, you know, push free. They finally get free, but then they find out that there's material caught in what's those called? The spinny things.
The turbines.
The propellers.
Propellers.
Yeah, that either one. Pick or choose. I just went blank there for a second. Oh, keep it together, man. Keep it together. Okay. They find out that the tissue, there's a team of two scientists, which we'll get to more about them, but they do research and find out that the material is from a large octopus that was living out in the deep trenches of the Pacific Ocean and was disturbed by the atomic bombings out there because they were testing atomic bombs back in during World War II, and that now the creature is radioactive and it's looking for food, and so it starts attacking coastal regions. It attacks a boat, and then it attacks San Francisco.
So this was something I didn't quite understand about it. Was the implication that because it got irradiated from the bombs, that it hungered for radiation, or just that it killed its food source and now it just has a taste for the human meat, as it were?
No, it took me a minute to understand it too, but I finally did. What they were saying is fish are sensitive to radioactivity. They can sense radioactivity and they can avoid it if they, you know, if they swim around it or get away from it. So right. When all of those nuclear bombs went off and it irradiated the octopus, it can no longer catch its prey because the fish can tell it's there and avoid it because they can sense the radioactivity coming off of the octopus.
Okay.
And so the octopus is running out of food. It's starving because there's no fish available to it, because every time it goes to try to catch fish, the fish get away from it and like avoid it.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense now, because they explain it like two or three times in the movie. Yeah. And each time I'm like, I don't get it.
Yeah. I know, I had to think about it whenever I was like, I had to pause it. I'm like, wait a minute, what? And I was like, oh, now I get it. Okay.
it's basically just a way to say, oh, this is why an octopus is attacking.
Yeah, it's also a way to make it more sympathetic. It's not trying to hurt people. Well, I mean, it's trying to hurt people, but it's starving. You can't blame it. It's starving.
Right. I mean, it's humans who nuked the crap out of it, so.
Yeah.
I mean, who's the real victim here?
Right. Us. They disturbed its food source, and yeah. Oh, goodness. So, yeah.
But that's pretty much, like, the first, like... That's almost like the first, like, 40 minutes is just them. You don't actually see it, the octopus itself, when it gets attached to the sub. And then it's just the scientists researching it for about 40 minutes. And then after that, we finally get some more of it.
I do kind of like the fact that the scientists didn't have the answer right away. And it actually took time for them to figure out what it was. You know, it's like they didn't show up to the lab saying, yes, this is a giant octopus. It's like, no, we did a lot of tests, and it took, like, I think they said 2 weeks before they actually got the results of, you know, what it was like. Nowadays in a movie like this, it would be just like type in a computer, you know, just do the click 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 click, and then you know what it is. So it's like a 3D
you just
model.
See a character and they're like, okay, Google, and it immediately comes up with what they need.
Like, hey Siri, what is a giant octopus look like? Or what does a giant octopus look like?
What is this?
Yeah. Hold on 1 second. Oh, I don't think it's gonna do it with me on the phone. Dang it. I was gonna try it.
I do like how they don't get the answers immediately, but it does take like what feels like forever for them to get to that, because there's not like a whole lot there that happens while they're researching it.
Right.
It's pretty much just shots of them in the lab.
I like the captain from the Navy, who's just like, when the general or whoever calls and he's like, you know, no sir, let me ask them if they have any results, and he just looks and then he says, no sir, they don't have anything yet, because it's just like oh goodness, it's like they're working on it, we'll let you know.
We'll get there when we get there.
Right. Yeah, so, do you want to talk about the scientists now?
Sure, yeah. Might as well get it out of the way early.
Okay, so you have this man and woman team of scientists who, the man is bland and generic and whatever, and then the woman is portrayed and talked about as kind of like she's this forward-thinking woman who is like, you know, I'm gonna, you know, be a working woman and I'm not going to settle down with any man. I'm just gonna, you know, focus on my work and I don't take no for an answer. I'm the expert here because, you know, I know more about any of this stuff than anyone else and I'm not afraid to stand up for myself. And so, you know, so I kind of liked her character at first because I'm like, oh, yeah, they're actually having an empowered woman in this movie in the 1950s. But it's all negated by Captain Creepy Pants and his stalker eyes. Stalker eyes.
I think, too, like, what's nice about her character is that she's, like, a strong, independent woman, which sometimes gets undercut in the movie, right. But she's never, like, it never comes across as, like, super in your face. It's just,
yeah.
She's the expert, and this is what she does, and it's all the characters around her that kind of ruined that a little bit, and, yeah. And, like, some of the writing that the writers give her later on that kind of undercuts that. But, yeah. Let's get back to Creepy Pants, like you were mentioning.
Yeah, Captain Creepy Pants and his stalker eyes. Oh, my goodness. He was looking at her the way I imagine Ted Bundy looking at his victims. It is so disturbing. And so awful. Like, what were you doing, dude?
yeah, and it's, like, really, it's, like, you see it a lot from, like, movies and films of this... Movies and films are the same thing. You see it a lot from, like, media of this era, where it was, like, his character's, like, kind of the strong-armed, masculine character that's, like, It's watching it in 2018 is just a little problematic.
Yeah.
Because he's kind of like one of those, like, I don't take no for an answer type of characters from that time.
Yeah, it's a little...
Literally grabs her by the arm multiple times in the movie, and it's, like, very uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah, it's a little rapey. It's just a little bit.
It's not... Yeah, definitely. It definitely is rapey, for sure.
So, yeah, I just... And he was just so annoying because it's like... Dude, there is a giant freaking octopus eating people, and you are more focused on what's in your pants than anything else.
Exactly. Like,
get a grip, well, it's dude. Funny. No, don't get a grip.
Oh,
you know what he reminded me of? Yeah. He reminded me, okay, like, sometimes when a dog is, like, really excited and starts humping your leg, like, if it's a big dog, you'll push it away. Like, no, no, down, no, no, get away. But if it's just, like, an itty-bitty little, like, chihuahua or something, sometimes you'll just ignore it and let it do its thing until it's tired and just wanders off. That's what he seemed like.
I don't think I've ever done that. I always push him away, Travis.
I'm just thinking. I told you. I am too tired to be recording tonight. But, like, it's just a little chihuahua, so it's like, I don't, you know, whatever, do your thing. I'm watching TV, so just whatever. It's different if it's like a Great Dane, because it's like, no, no, get off of me. But if it's a little chihuahua that barely comes up to your ankle, whatever. Just, okay, whatever. And so I feel like that's what this guy is. Like, he was constantly, like, dry humping her leg, and she's just like, whatever, just, you know, just let, you know, just letting it go, just dealing with it, because, like, maybe he'll tire himself out and then he'll leave me alone.
She, it's weird because what they try to do with him is they're, he's supposed to be this, like, he comes across as a chauvinistic kind of pig, and then throughout the movie, she always pushes away his advances.
Yeah.
But then there's, like, still an air of, like, oh, but I kind of am into him, where it doesn't seem like if there was a woman of this period who was putting herself forward as a strong, independent woman,
right,
she wouldn't still be like, oh, but I'm so attracted to him still.
Right.
She'd just think he was a pig and, like, pay him no mind.
Yeah.
Or completely ignore him.
Yeah.
And it kind of seems like they were trying to do where, oh, this guy's such a pig, and then he gets told off because she's a strong, independent woman. And he gets told off by another man, of course.
Right.
But, and at the end of the movie, he's like, well, maybe these new type of women aren't so bad after all. And it's like, maybe they were trying to go for, like, oh, he's changed his ways. He's not a complete pig like you think.
Yeah.
But, no, he's still a pig through and through the entire movie.
Yep. Yep. The creepy, creepy stalker eyes don't lie.
Right.
The eyes are.
And
the...
it's funny that.
I was going to say
they just stare you down into your soul.
Yeah, well, I was going to say the eyes are the window to the soul, and his soul says, I am going to tie you up and lock you in my basement.
Yeah. But yeah, there's. It feels like from this era, there's like a million male characters that are like this. Which doesn't make it right or better, but it's like, it's definitely like uncomfortable to watch.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So now, okay, I have something going off. Now we're moving past that. When the scientists actually explain the fact that it's a giant octopus that's out there, and they're explaining that to the, like, generals and the head of the Navy and all that kind of stuff. They're trying to explain how there's no way that any Navy ships can catch this creature because it moves too fast, because it's jet-propelled. And so he says, it's like a balloon. And he pulls out a balloon from his pocket and says, you know, it's like this. It fills its body with the water around it, and then it shoots it out and propels itself, and then he lets the balloon go. Was he just carrying a balloon with him at all times just in case he had to explain something like this?
He's a full-time scientist, part-time clown, and he just happens to have it in his pocket.
Like, why is this balloon in your pocket, dude? What are you doing with this balloon?
He's like, a balloon for every occasion. Just pulling out different balloons.
I'd love for him to be, like you said, the clown, and pull out one of the really long balloons and then tie it up into the shape of an octopus and then poke it with a pin and let the thing go around. It's like, see, this is an octopus. Now this is an octopus when it's swimming.
He's just really into visual aids.
I just was like, what is that balloon doing in your pocket, dude? Do you just carry random balloons with you? He's got a bad helium addiction.
It's one of his used up helium pods.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned that you found him to be kind of bland, because I actually ended up preferring him to the Freaky Pants dude.
I think it was the fact that there was just no character development for this guy other than to him be the other man who's just there to be in the way of Captain Creepy Pants and his murder eyes. I feel the magic between
you and I. What's funny about him, though, is, like, he's not even in the way of him, either. Because he's, like, immediately, like, oh, yeah, the female scientist, she can do whatever she pleases. This is our plan, but, you know.
Yeah, he's like, whatever, dude. Go for it.
Yeah, he fully buys into her being strong and independent, which I kind of liked him for that, because he was, he's very nice. But then also later on in the movie, he gets to do some, like, pretty cool things, and he has the coolest name ever. Of course, it's stolen, but he has his name is John Carter, like those old Edgar Rice Burroughs books, which is a super cool
John
name.
Carter. Yeah, I like that because I like John Carter. I like the books and stuff. Right. So yeah, that is cool.
He's definitely a dork early on, but he gets better as it goes.
Well, he was just like, to me, especially early on, he was just nothing. You know, he was just a blank slate, really.
Right.
But I agree with you. Yeah, he did do more things later on. He became more heroic, I guess, and actually became, you know, like, he did some essential things that helped accomplish what they were accomplishing. Actually, wasn't he the one that actually did it? That
yeah.
actually killed the monster? Yeah, so, yeah, yeah, so, I mean, it, oh, he, sorry, he became more, like, developed as a character later on, but just for the first half of this movie, it was just like, he was just a blank slate.
I think, honestly, I was zoning out so much during the first half because of how slow it is that I kind of mostly remember the second more exciting half.
Yeah, and you know, that is a running theme through all of these old movies, is how slow they feel at first, and then later on as the, you know, action picks up. I mean, that's something that's going to be apparent in all of these old monster movies. They're all like that. But the funny thing is, this movie has the same runtime as, or almost the same runtime as Gorgo.
Right.
But man, did it not feel like it.
Not at all. Gorgo is a much easier pill to swallow compared to this movie. This is like a pill that you're trying to swallow.
Yeah, well, I mean, Gorgo, within the first, like, 10 minutes of the movie, you see the monster. And it goes away for a little while, and you don't see it again for a little while. But, I mean, like, it's there. The things happen in the first, like, 10 minutes of the movie. And right. so, and this movie is just like, oh, it takes forever to get to the, which, like I said, I like this movie. I like this movie a lot, but I'm going to criticize the things I think deserve to be criticized, and that's one of them. And that's one of them about all giant monster movies. I mean, even the modern ones, even that's the biggest complaint about Godzilla 2014, the Gareth Edwards version, is that it was so slow and boring until you get to the monsters, and then you're excited for the monsters. So the last bit of it is great, but just the rest of it is just, you know, a slog.
Right. It would have been cool because they had a chance to put the creature in, like, the opening scene, basically, when it attacks the submarine. But for some reason, they're just like, you get to see this entire event happen from within the submarine. And that's probably like a budgetary cut. But it would have been cool to see it, like, wrapped around the sub and then them eventually breaking free of it.
Yeah. One other scene kind of made me chuckle, early on was when they were in the lab and, the first time that the female doctor, I'm not going to try to, you know, remember her name or anything. Cause in the movie, that's all she was basically was the female doctor. So when she was leaving the lab after doing all the work and finding out that it was a giant octopus, and then the Captain Creepy Eyes follows her, he walks past a giant no smoking sign with a lit cigarette in his mouth. It is not like a subtle thing that you have to be looking for. Like, there is a gigantic no smoking sign right behind him while he's smoking that cigarette and talking to her, trying to, you know, like, basically essentially humping her leg.
That's how you know he's such a bad boy, is he smokes and no smoking.
Yeah, he's not a bad boy. He was just, oh, he was so dumb. Okay, instead of, like, dwelling on all of the boring stuff for the movie, let's just jump to the giant octopus attacking San Francisco.
Well, let's do all the giant octopus scenes, because there's one scene right before it gets to San Francisco where, like we mentioned before, it attacks that model ship, and that is super cool.
Yeah.
it's super cool because you're on the deck and you see the huge arm come up And they actually spliced the two scenes together really well. Like, it looks like it's actually there and, like, crashing on the ship. Yeah, and there's not too much more to the ship being brought down to plot-wise, but it's definitely cool to see. And it's, like, raining and stormy and just awesome. Just really cool.
Okay. Something that ties into that. Now, when the survivors of that ship being sunk and they get checked out by the doctor, and the guy is trying to explain to him what they saw and what made their ship sink. This guy is a seasoned, experienced fisherman, and the only way he could explain tentacles was, it's like those things, talking about the stethoscope.
Right.
And it's like, dude, you can explain better than that.
Right. You have seen, you know, an octopus, what an octopus before. Is. Yeah.
Yes. You know what an octopus is. It's not like, I mean, yeah, you've never seen one that big before, but you know what it is. And so then he gets locked up in, like, the crazy side of the hospital, because they, you know, the mental health side of the hospital, because he's supposedly crazy, which scares the other men into not, you know, telling anything, and they end up backing out of their stories and stuff. And anyway, it seemed like just like a nothing plot that was, or like a side story that just like didn't need to happen, but it was still kind of like, dude, you're a fisherman. You know what a tentacle is.
Yeah, it was just them trying to fill up some of their runtime quota.
Yeah. We also, while we're on this train too, there's also the scene of the beach where the scientist lady and the creepy eyes captain had to go and investigate the disappearance of this family and everything on the beach. And they find the suction cup, like, indentions into the sand. One of the fun facts that I had, that whole scene is done on a soundstage instead of being shot at an actual beach. And the actor was sinking into the sand every time that they would shoot. So he actually was, by the time they were finished shooting their one shot, he was shorter than the woman. because he was sinking into the sand, he had to dig himself out of the sand.
That's hilarious. That is cool, too, yeah, when you see the suction cup indentation in the sand. Because it's just like this big, huge circle.
It's neat. Yeah, I like that the local, like, sheriff or whoever is like, doesn't believe them.
Yeah,
and stuff. I guess then now we can cut to the attack on San Francisco. So you have the Navy putting up an electric fence across the bay, and or an electric net across the bay, and like dropping depth charges and other mines and stuff, trying to keep this creature from making it into the San Francisco Bay, because San Francisco is a very populated place. And none of it works. And the electricity...
And it's going so poorly that they're like, you know what, instead of trying to push it away, we're going to try to capture it inside the bay.
Right,
which has its own issues.
Yeah, plan B. Oh, goodness. And so the octopus crawls onto, starts off with just its tentacle coming up onto the Golden Gate Bridge. And I know that there's like 3 or 4 movies that has that scene playing in the background of the movie. I think Men in Black is one of them. I think either Men in Black 1 or Men in Black 2 has that scene playing in the background in one of the scenes. You know, I don't remember exactly which one. And there's at least 1 or 2 TV shows that have shown that scene. So that's what I meant in our last episode, where even if you haven't seen this movie, you have seen parts of this movie. Because it does, that scene of the tentacle coming up out of the water onto the Golden Gate Bridge is one that makes it into other movies.
And it's a super cool scene, too. Like, seeing the, like, octopus, like, it basically, like, pulls itself up out of the water onto the bridge and like wraps its tentacles around it and starts to pull the bridge down. It's super neat that all of the that, like we mentioned before, all of the effects stuff right there, super cool.
Yeah, and like we were saying with, or I know I was saying it, the way Harryhausen has this way of making them feel organic. Like, you, I mean, you can still tell it's stop motion because, you know, our eyes are, especially nowadays, because it was such a thing that existed, so we can kind of tell that it's not as smooth and, you know, as a living being. But
right,
it still looks organic. And I just love that Ray Harryhausen can bring these things to life and make you feel like this thing is actually alive.
Right. Yeah, it feels so organic, not only in, like, the movement of it, but also in, like, just visually how it looks. Mm-hmm. Like, you can tell it's not real, but that's actually part of the reason I was asking what it was made out of earlier, was because you look at it and you're just like, that looks actually really good for the time. I wonder how they did that.
Yeah.
And you just kind of, it makes you appreciate the craft that goes into it.
The only thing I know for sure is that the metal frame for the, or like the metal skeleton for it, was made by Ray Harryhausen's father. But I don't know the rest of the material that Harryhausen used to make the actual creature itself. But I do know I do remember reading somewhere that the metal frame was actually built by his dad.
I was thinking clay at first, but because it looks so solid, I kind of wasn't as sure if it was clay. But this
style of animation is also known as claymation, because a lot of the models were clay. And Harryhausen does use clay in other movies. I'm just not sure about this particular one if that was the case.
Right.
So it wraps itself around the Golden Gate Bridge and tears down the Golden Gate Bridge. It is an awesome scene. It's so cool. And then it goes into the bay and crawls onto land and starts terrorizing the people in the city. So you see the tentacles coming through onto, you know, main streets and all that kind of stuff and trying to grab people and everything. And that, again, looks so good.
Mm-hmm. And, it's super cool because you can tell they had to do, like, a whole miniature of the city itself, like, where it was coming onto land. So you get to see, like, almost an aerial shot of it moving its way onto the land and then, like, attacking the people. All that is, like, really neat, yeah.
Yeah, and like you had said earlier, the composite where they, you know, put the two scenes over top of each other with the live-action actors and actresses, it looks almost seamless. Like, I mean, you know, I've seen worse. So this
from what I remember, I think Gorgo might edge it out a little bit more, but it still looks pretty great.
Yeah. You were a big fan of the composite scenes in Gorgo. I'm looking forward to when we get to another Harryhausen film called Beast from 10,000 Fathoms. The composite scenes in those is like still considered some of the best compositing ever in film history. So I'm wondering, you know, how you'll feel about that when you get to it.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's one that's usually like shown and featured whenever people are talking about this claymation animation and how good the compositing can be.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that.
Yeah. So they eventually chase the octopus back in the Navy, they being the Navy, chase the octopus back out into the water and it's just sitting there.
Well, they use like, they Gorgo it. They bring in the flamethrowers to push it back into the ocean.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Cause fire is the enemy of all giant monsters. Everyone knows this, that no matter what monster there is, they're all afraid of fire. I mean, think of it. Think about it. We've got Gorgo. We've got this monster. We've got Frankenstein. We've got the aliens from Alien. is afraid of, you know, a flamethrower. You've got the Thing from John Carpenter's right. The Thing is afraid of fire. So it's just like that is just a known
holy
thing.
Crap. I never thought about it before, but you're totally right.
I'm not kidding. That is a trope in monster movies that has existed forever and still happens to this day.
So maybe it's just such uh-huh. a thing of like since fire is such a symbol of like how civilized man is, and it's like something that we can make that they always turn to. But that is funny how so many things have also Martian Manhunter weakness fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coincidence? I think not.
Yeah. I think if you want to get all Freudian on it, I think that, yeah, maybe it does have something to do with it is this primal thing that we as people associate with man's dominance over nature, because, you know, we're the only ones who can produce fire and control fire. Although, just found out recently, they're having trouble down in Australia with birds starting fires. Have you heard about this?
I have not heard about this.
Okay, so
nature's fighting back.
Yeah, no, nature's fighting back. So they have bushfires in Australia all the time in the summertime and or in the dry seasons, and
right,
because, you know, it's usually like lightning will strike or something like that. But what they started noticing was that a fire would start in a distance and then another fire would start just a little ways away from it with no seemingly like connection to that fire, but somehow get started at the same time or around the same time. And locals had started saying, well, we're seeing birds carrying flaming twigs and flaming pieces of wood. And what's happening is it's these birds of prey. I forget exactly what kind. Well, I think there's multiple kinds that do it, but there's this one kind that they were talking about on this article I was reading, that it's a bird of prey, so it eats small animals like mice and rabbits and stuff, things that live in dense bush area. And when a fire starts in one area, it will pick up a burning ember and bring that over to another area where it likes to hunt and drop it in there and start a fire in this location so it can chase out its prey and hunt its prey. So it's like these birds...
Oh my
birds...
God. It's literally smoking out its prey. That's ingenious. That's awesome.
It's smoking out its prey. Someone sent me the article on Facebook, and it's not, and it wasn't like a, you know, BuzzFeed article or anything like that. It was like from an actual like scientific thing, magazine or whatever, that was talking about it, because now they're wanting to do studies in other places, like in here in the United States, when we have like the wildfires in California, and they want people to keep an eye out and see if they see birds here doing the same thing. That might explain why some of the California fires spread so fast, that birds are actually making the fires worse. And it's just like, what is up with Australia? like you said, nature's fighting back.
Oh, Australia is where they draw the line in the sand.
Yeah, it's, oh goodness. It was crazy. So, yeah. So, I just thought that was funny. We're talking about, like, fire, you know, being, like, a symbol for, you know, man's control over nature. And then the birds are using fires to, you know, and they're just trying to catch their prey. They don't realize right. that the land that they're setting on fire belongs to someone and has a house on it. Like, so they're actually burning people's houses down trying to get their prey. Just... makes you glad. Makes you glad that we don't have the giant, like, meat-eating birds anymore. Like that those like giant carnivorous birds are no longer around. They're extinct now, because if they figured that trick out, we'd be in trouble.
Who says extinction isn't good?
Yeah. extinction, sometimes a good thing. Oh, goodness. So, speaking of which, they blast this octopus. I mean, we can talk about how they do it. They use a special rocket that launches itself and digs itself into its skin, then blows it up from the inside.
Right.
Captain Creepy Creeperson and his murder eyes goes out and tries to do it, and he fails, and the explosion knocks him out underwater. And so then John Carter, the doctor, decides to go himself and do it, and he succeeds, and then the sub comes around, picks him up. So here's my question. They did say that that octopus was radioactive, right? That's right. That's why it was, you know, scaring away its own prey, and so it had to hunt bigger prey like humans.
Mm-hmm.
That was an awful lot of bits and pieces that just floated off in the currents from that monster, from that octopus.
Well, we also know that it's like a dangerous amount of radiation because it affects the submarine earlier in the movie to the point where they could get like a lethal exposure. So not only do they explode it all over San Francisco Bay, but then these two dudes like saddle up right next to it without any protective gear.
Yeah. And it's just left at that. And so it's like, I think this is going to cause a bigger problem than just a giant octopus. like, maybe the giant octopus wasn't going to actually be as big of a problem as what the after effects of blowing it into small bits and having the currents take it across the entire world. You're talking about, like nuclear radiation traveling through the currents over to Asia and to other places. This is like a Chernobyl kind of disaster now.
Well, if anyone was going to ruin the water supplies for the entire world, it would be the Americans.
Yep, it'd be the Americans. It'd be the Californians. Oh, California. anyway. So, yeah, that was
so the
was
movie
my...
kind of ends with... We get Crapton. We get Captain Creepy Pants
Crapton.
And the good doctor John Carter, along with the female scientist, who I feel bad that I don't remember her name. And they're at this like dinner at the end, and they're like, "It's just dumb."
Leslie Joyce was her name.
Is that her character name or just her actor name?
No, that's her character name.
Okay. Oh, yeah, because they call her Joyce, basically, for the whole movie.
Yeah, yeah. And, and so they're having dinner, and a news report comes on. It's like, oh, there's three people, you know, the San Francisco Bay it was saved today by the hard work of the United States Navy and Coast Guard, but we cannot forget three people who were essential to destroying this monster. And they're like, oh, it's gonna be us. And then it's like, you know, the fire department and the local police department, and I forget what the other one was.
It's like
people or whatever.
Road crossing guards.
Crossing guards and stuff who helped evacuate people in an orderly manner so that there were no casualties. And they're like, I guess we won't get our 15 minutes of fame. It's like, you discovered and blew up a giant octopus. You're fine.
Yeah, if I was them, I would not want anyone to know that I possibly just made a species of giant octopus go extinct.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about something after I say this. But yeah, there was something else I thought of.
And so it kind of ends again on that note we were mentioning earlier where Joyce still goes for Captain Creepy Pants, even though she's a strong, independent woman, and he's a total creep and doesn't respect her at all. She still goes with him at the end of the movie, and the other guy's like, "Well, I guess that's life." And it's just,
But they're still, but she's still going to Egypt to research things. She's a marine biologist. What she's doing in Egypt, I don't know, but.
She's going to the Nile.
Isn't that?
No, it was something like. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, no, it doesn't.
The human plot in this movie is the most, like, it doesn't really matter part of it. It's pretty much you're just here for the monster scenes.
Exactly. But she's a marine biologist. The fact that they discovered and identified and actually destroyed a new species of colossal, gigantic octopus, I think she's going to have more fame and attention than just a newscaster on the radio. Like, this is still a big deal to the, you know, marine biology, like, people. So,
right, you'd think they'd want to study it more.
Yeah, you'd think that there'd be more, you know, fanfare for the fact that, hey, this was a crucial discovery. Also, she says that, you know, she says so casually that, oh, it must have come from this trench. You know, there's a lot of sea creatures that live in that trench. Like, it's just, like, no big deal. Like, no.
Maybe that was them trying to set up a franchise. They're like, oh, there's more sea creatures that live under there.
Yeah. That was my other thing.
It also came from beneath the sea.
Yeah, that was my other thing. Was like, you're just kind of casually throwing around the idea that there might be more of these out there. Okay. In 2007, there was a comic book series that came out from Tidal Wave Productions. I'm not sure who exactly what Tidal Wave Productions is. I think they do like movie tie-ins and stuff for comic books. They put out a comic book miniseries called It Came From Beneath the Sea Again. And that, it was part of their Ray Harryhausen signature series. So they were doing like comic books for a bunch of Ray Harryhausen movies. And right. This continued the story from where the movie leaves off. Because, like, I'm not kidding. It's called It Came From Beneath the Sea, .. Again.
That sounds like a parody.
Yeah, I know. And the first issue, or at least a preview of the first issue, was included in the 50th anniversary DVD for this movie. So, I mean, there's a comic book out there based on this movie that we can read for our comic book episode.
That one might be way further down the line.
It didn't even come out in 2007. It was supposed to be coming out in 2007, and it was delayed until 2011.
It was delayed 4 years?
Okay, here's the Tidal Wave Productions is an independent production studio of comic books and graphic novels based in Vancouver, Washington, United States. They publish biographical comics, adaptations from films, and original titles with self-created characters. Here's some of the titles of the Harryhausen movies that they did. So, Ray Harryhausen did Clash of the Titans. They did the comic book series Wrath of the Titans, which makes sense because there was the sequel to the emotionless guy. What's his name?
Sam Worthington.
Yeah, the guy.
I do not blame you for forgetting his name.
I know. I always forget his name. I think I get him and Sam Witwer confused, and I don't know why. Because Sam Witworth has so much personality, and right. Sam Worthington has none. So I don't know why. But yeah, so there was a sequel to that movie called Wrath of the Titans, and that was the actual sequel comic book to the original Clash of the Titans. Comic book came out first. They also have 20 Million Miles More, which is a sequel to 20 Million Miles to Earth. it takes place 50 years after the events of the film. It came from beneath the sea again. Sinbad, Rogue of Mars, which is a
that
sequel.
That's not
comic
the worst title.
Rogue of Mars, I think. Yeah. So you know, the Harryhausen films that that one is following up from is The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, which is one of my personal favorites. The Golden Voyage of Sinbad and Sinbad and the Eye of the Tiger. And that it's actually based on a movie that they were going to do, but they scrapped, that was part of those Sinbad movies that was going to be Sinbad Goes to Mars. This is like crazy. Flying
I
saucers.
I wonder if they're any good.
I'm kind of interested in reading these now. Oh,
I wonder
I
if they have them
available
digitally, or if it's just like, I guess you're going to have to just try to find the, hunt down the prince.
Yeah. Yeah, I am. So they also have Flying Saucers versus the Earth, which is a sequel to the movie Earth versus the Flying Saucer. And these are all the Harryhausen movies too. There's this one is the one I'm probably will not read, even though I'm kind of interested in it, because it's called Back to the to Mysterious Island. So it's, you know, follow up to The Mysterious Island. Right. It is a 4-issue comic book miniseries created by Max Landis.
I don't mind Max Landis's comic books.
I mind everything about Max Landis.
I mind all of the dodgy stuff that's coming out about him now. But other than that, I don't mind it.
I hated Max Landis before it was cool.
I don't think you're the only one. There's a lot of hate towards Max Landis.
There are very few people in this world that I like just hate, because I'm a person of, you know, I may hate the work that they do, I may hate, you know, something about them, but I'm everybody deserves a chance, everybody can change, you know, whatever. I'm just that kind of person of just whatever. Max Landis is just one of those people I despise with every fiber of my being, that I just couldn't hold my luncheon if I had to stand next to him. I would be, what did we say, pjorging. I would be pjorging all over the place. War of the Elementals, which is a sequel to the Elementals movie, which was, you know, Ray Harryhausen, and the last one, The Pit and the Pendulum, which is a comic book adaptation based on the Ray Harryhausen movie by the same name, based on the story by Edgar Allan Poe. So yeah, so there's like an entire series of books based on these old Harry, and we talked about during the Gorgo episode that there's like the Gorgo comic book too from Charlton Comics,
right?
So it's those like all, we need to do
it's ahead. Interesting that they have sequels to them. The only knock I'll have against them is that all of their sequel names were like one or two here.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a throwback to the 1950s, because that's the 1950s style of naming something. I mean, this movie is called It Came From Beneath the Sea, but if you type in It Came From, you'd get a million things with the same title. It came from outer space, it came from beyond space, it came from another planet, it came from Earth, it came from, you know, like...
It came from Earth, like, I mean, the story of humans.
Yeah, yeah, it came from Earth. So yeah, there's... like, I'm not bothered by it. That feels intentional to me. Like, that's not like, oh, we just accidentally named these really, really poorly. No, this feels intentionally like that. Because that's what it would be if these were actually movies made in the 1950s. So, yeah, we've got to do an episode about all the comic books that are based on movies that we're talking about.
Definitely. Definitely. We'll have to see how accessible those ones are.
Yeah. Well, and especially I want to go back and do the Gorgo one, because the Gorgo one actually came out just a year after the movie did. So it wasn't even like these were made in the 2000s as a tribute to Ray Harryhausen. The Gorgo one was like at the time the movie came out, they put out this comic book for people to read. And I'm kind of interested to see what they did with it and what they added, you know, to the movie. Oh, goodness. Anyway.
Well, I guess that... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm done. I was just going to say that's enough rambling from me.
You're fine. Was there... Did you have any, like, kind of final thoughts on It Came From Beneath the Sea?
It Came From Beneath the Sea is not the best Ray Harryhausen film, but if you are doing any kind of look into Ray Harryhausen's catalog of work, you will not be disappointed by this film. The effects are as good as what you expect if you know anything about Harryhausen and his work. So I would definitely say watch it. It's a watch it for me. I bought it. I didn't just, you know, like rent it or I bought it. I'm going to buy each time we do a Harryhausen film, I'm going to purchase it because I want to own all of them. I have not put together my collection of them yet, so I am, you know, trying to do that now.
So for me, I'm going to give this one yet again the Jake Look It Up on YouTube special, where I think all of the Harryhausen scenes are amazing. The plot outside of that is very much of the time, and the creepy pants kind of ruins it for me, just because he's kind of like that strong-armed chauvinist that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
So, but all of the Harryhausen scenes are excellent. So yeah, definitely see those, if anything. I can't give it a full recommend just because of all of the dated stuff in it.
Well, I don't know if you're aware, and I know you are because I told you about this when we were putting the podcast together, but we have a rating system that you're not sticking to.
Okay, well, never... then I'll say pass on this movie.
No, you do not pass on a Ray Harryhausen movie. You do not. I will fight you on this one.
Well, if you want to watch a movie full of 1950s sexism, then go for it. But if you don't, then skip it.
See, I honestly think you can have fun with this. Like, the Ray Harryhausen effects are so good. It's worth sitting through this stuff. But even the bad stuff is on that level of, it was fun to watch how bad it was.
Oh, it wasn't fun for me. It was super cringe.
I was making fun of it. I was yelling at the TV and like making fun of it as I was reading it. Or reading it, watching it.
The Harryhausen stuff is great. I will say that. But it only makes up about like 10 minutes of actual footage in the movie.
No, there's more than that. I mean, the movie's only 70 minutes long.
I know. I mean, the Harryhausen stuff is pretty short, though.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, it's still, you know, I think it's more than just, like, 10 minutes. It took 10 minutes for the octopus to get onto the bridge. I understand. I definitely understand that viewpoint of, yeah, this is a very of-its-time movie and stuff, but I'm a sucker for those things. I am a sucker for movies that are, like, so of their time that they're just fun to watch in the context. Like, I you know, sitting here and yelling and making fun of Captain Creepy Eyes through the entire, while I'm watching the movie, was fun. And so I'm like, I enjoy watching these movies, and it's worth it to go through all of that and then see the actual, like, really good monster work that, if you enjoy monster movies, you cannot do better than a Ray Harryhausen film. So yeah.
I guess it just depends on how much mileage you can get out of it. For me personally, I can't get that much mileage out of the human stuff, but like the monster stuff, Great.
We need to start watching these movies together so that we can, like, you can hear me yelling at the TV as I'm on. It's like, I grew up, I loved watching Mystery Science Theater 3000. Like, that was my thing. I'd watch that religiously. So when I'm watching a movie that's so bad that it's just, like, you know, just awful, and I have no issues with just starting to scream at the television or yell at the television or making fun of it and riffing on it and everything. And that's what makes it fun.
I can do that with some things sometimes. It's just for this particular one, I wasn't able to work with it that way.
Yeah, I think that's the only reason I really enjoyed Godzilla Monster Planet was because I was able to just sit there and yell at the TV anytime that the main character made me angry.
I don't know if I would call that enjoyed based on what we talked about.
Well, not me, because you can't do that when you're at, okay, if you're at a party or even at a movie night with a bunch of friends and they're all gathered around, they're really, you know, interested in this movie, you know, you don't want to be the jerk that just yells things out at the TV and stuff. I've done that before, but I don't like being the jerk, but I do it sometimes. I watched my friend's uncle had a built-in movie theater in his house, in his basement, and with, like, the theater seats and everything. And so we watched, we went down there, and it was me and my friend, and then my friend's mom and his sister. And they, and the mom and the sister wanted to watch Phantom of the Opera, and us guys wanted to watch something else. So obviously we watched Phantom of the Opera. And there was a moment where, like, I kept holding it in, all of the, like, stuff that I wanted to just yell out and riff on and make fun of, and I was holding it in because I know how much they loved the Phantom of the Opera. But then when there's one scene in it where Raoul jumps off the, and I like the Phantom of the Opera, I'm not gonna, you know, say that I went to Broadway and actually saw it on Broadway, so I'm not saying anything bad about the Phantom of the Opera, but Raoul jumped off of something and landed on his horse, and the horse rears back, and I yelled out because I couldn't control myself, "Hi-hoo, Silver!" And my friend's mom gave me the ugliest death stare I have ever seen. So I'm like, yeah. So I can't do that when I'm around, like, those kinds of people, or at a movie theater, you can't do that. But you get the right group of people, and you can just have fun just making fun and savaging a movie.
Right. Yeah, definitely. For sure.
Oh, goodness. So, anyway, that's our episode for this week. We wanted to kind of cut it short, but I don't think we succeeded.
A little bit. It's a little shorter.
Shorter than last week, only because there was no rant about Legion.
That's okay, I cut that one out.
Yeah. So we had already mentioned it up top, but next week we're going to be discussing the new Cloverfield movie, Cloverfield Paradox, and we're going to discuss that. I'm going into it blind, not knowing anything about the movie. I haven't even seen
are you a big Cloverfield fan?
Well, I was just, like, I've seen the first one, and it's okay. You know, it's not, I mean,
right.
it's one of those whatever ones. Like, you know, it's not, it doesn't offend me, it didn't excite me, it's just like, eh, whatever. But I still have not watched 10 Cloverfield Lane, so, which, I mean, I know it's supposed go ahead.
I feel exactly the same way about both the first Cloverfield movie and 10 Cloverfield Lane.
Really?
Because just that kind of like, they're movies. They don't, they're not like, I don't know. They just don't click with me 100%.
Yeah. It's like, that didn't suck, but that's about as much as I can say about it. Because it didn't suck.
Right.
A lot of people,
I'm interested to hear what you think about this new one.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people really, really praised 10 Cloverfield Lane, and I know I still wanted to see it. I just haven't gotten around to seeing it yet. But Yeah, and so I'm very surprised to hear you were just kind of like, eh.
Yeah, and I think it might have been a little overhyped for me because I came to it, like, months after it had already been released.
Oh, yeah.
So that might have been a factor, but yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see how the Cloverfield paradox goes.
Yeah.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Okay.
Just to cut, I don't know where I'm going. I'm starting to get very tired, a little loopy.
Me too. So I think it's time for us to say goodbye. if you want to contact the show, you can email us at kaijuweekly@gmail.com. You can also tweet me at CaptainTravis55 and Jake at JakeTheNerdMan.
That's me.
And anything else? Let us know what you think of the show. If you've made it this far, we start getting into our rambling moods, and then I forget to mention, it's like, yeah, maybe, shut up a little bit. This is going to be the first piece of information that people give us. Like, yeah, maybe learn when to shut up. Mostly we'll directed see. Towards me.
Oh no. We'll see. Maybe we'll just have a bunch of fan mail that comes in that says, yes, Legion was the worst show ever.
Yeah. Oh man. Yeah, I'm just picturing, yeah, I really enjoyed the show, but the guy who sounds like he's 13 years old, he's a little annoying and just needs to shut up.
So you say that, but that could easily be me too.
No.
I don't think, you always say you sound so young, but I think you sound like a male man. Not a man. Oh, I'm losing it. Oh, no post
this
on
This is
Sundays.
Not getting cut out. I am leaving all this in. A mailman. I sound like a mailman.
Okay.
So, yeah. No, my voice is horrible. We'll just leave it at that. But anyway, okay. So, until next time, guys. We'll see you next week. Or, well, you'll hear us next week. We won't see you. We won't even hear you unless you email us. And I'll hear my own voice reading out your email.
If I read the email, I'll read the email in the voice of Samuel Jackson. That's my promise.
Yeah, I will. I was going to say I will guess what your voice sounds like, listener, and I will do an impression of it. But that's we know what happened the last time I tried to do an impression, and we had to cut an entire segment of me doing Short Round from Indiana Jones.
Oh, I thought you were talking about your French accent where I cut in Microsoft.
Oh yeah, that too. That too. I was like, man. The guy who sounds like a 13-year-old kid now suddenly sounds like a robot. It's like, well, yeah, because it was a robot doing my part because Jake cut my part out. He didn't like my French accent, and so he wanted to just get rid of it.
I do let it go for a very long time in that episode. Watch, this episode gets released, and it's just entirety, just me and the Microsoft Sam.
Yeah. That's going to be fun. Then I wouldn't even have to record. You could just type in what you want me to say. And then I Okay. We've gone on long enough. We'll see you. We'll. Bye, guys.
See you later.